And now you may proceed.
Krista Carlson, I represent the plaintiff appellant Eric Sorens. In 2006, Eric won the lottery while he was married to his wife, Julia Sorens, along with some other co-workers. And afterwards, they decided to engage in some gifting to some family members. One of those gifts is an issue in this case. They structured it for tax benefit purposes so that they loaned the money to Andy Wolf for a residence, and then he was to pay back $24,000 a year, and they would give those payments. The note and the deed of trust were issued in the names of both of their trusts. Eric Sorens had a trust, and Julia Sorens had a trust. And they were tenants in common on that promissory note and deed of trust. So each would effectively be forgiving $12,000 of that per year. Well, in July of 2009, Julia Sorens comes to Eric and says, my brother wants to get a different house. He doesn't like the one he has. He wants to get a different one. There won't be any more or less given, but, you know, he needs to get this different residence. And Eric says, well, you're going to do what you're going to do. They weren't particularly happily married at this time. By the end of July, Julia Sorens had left the marital home. They separated. By October, they were... Eric had filed a petition for divorce. At some time in July, the property was sold and a new residence was purchased. In July 15th, 2009, the funds were wired, funds from the sale of the first house were wired into Julia's account. Eric did not approve that transfer of funds going into only Julia Sorens' account. There is nothing in the record that are going to be took the depositions of the bank personnel and said, we don't know that he ever authorized this. There is nothing in writing that authorizing this. So Julia had this whole entire, about $271,000, wired into her account. Now, she then made another loan to Andy Wolf's wife, Sarah Whitney, about right at $200,000 was loaned to her, a new promissory note, deed of trust made only in Julia's name. Eric was completely left off of it, and then she loaned Sarah Whitney about $50,000 more and kept $20,000 in the account and shared with Eric. Well, Eric didn't realize this, and of course they're going through this divorce, and attorneys are sent back and forth from counsel. Tim Clare had originally represented both Julia and Erica in the underlying transactions with property sales, but now Tim Clare is representing just Julia Sorens. And another attorney, James Hoppe, is representing Eric, of course. Well, attorney Hoppe sends a letter and says, you know, I'm assuming these gifts can be discontinued at any time, and that assumption is not corrected. It's clear throughout the divorce proceedings that Eric thinks his name is still on the new notes, or that he's been given half the money, but that he has gotten his fair share. And part of the reason for that is that in August, attorney Claire sends a letter, to Eric Sorens, and it says, I'm going to make sure, or it asks him to sign a deed of reconveyance. It says, I'm going to make sure this isn't filed until you have your money. Make sure you're paid back and the funds are there in full. And so he's being lulled into thinking he's going to get his share of this. Well, then in April, there's a final hearing of the divorce action,
and it's done.
And the divorce is over. But then in August of 2012, Eric realizes, oh, where's my money? I don't have it. Some correspondence is exchanged, and he realizes what happened. They won't give him his money. They won't give him his share. And so in October, he files this lawsuit. One of the reasons that this was wrongful is that under the UCC, when a negotiable instrument, like what we have here, is payable to two parties, it can't be negotiated just by one. Both of them have to sign off on that. Okay, well, the court below finds that order in the divorce action is an accord and satisfaction, that was to settle all of the issues. The problem with that is that there are elements of an accord and satisfaction, and one of those elements is that there's a bona fide dispute. There wasn't any bona fide dispute during the divorce. Julia had what she wanted. She thought, well, hey, I've got it. I've hoodwinked him. Fine. Eric thought that he had his property. He didn't realize that she had taken it. So there was no argument between them until after the divorce action was already over. Second.
So does the record tell us what happened to the note?
Well, it shows you that the funds were wired in. There's no, except for the deed of reconveyance, there's no real paperwork that comes with that transaction.
Well, there was a promissory note at one point, wasn't there?
There was that original promissory note to both of the trusts.
And what happened to it? Where is it?
That's a good question. The funds were wired over, and there was never any authorization to have them taken off that promissory note, off the deed of trust. There's nothing. Just the funds were transferred in a new note. He did sign the deed of reconveyance for the property, the title issues, but he never relinquished his rights to that promissory note or the deed of trust.
And the record doesn't tell us who had the note to begin with.
Well, who had the note to begin with was both the trusts.
No, I'm not talking about the names on the note. What I'm talking about, who had it in his or her physical possession? Where was it?
That I don't know. I assume it was at the lawyer's office, but I don't actually know who had control of the note itself. I'm sorry, that isn't in the record that I've seen. I don't know who actually had the physical note.
Are you contending that, to backtrack just a little bit in your argument, are you contending that because Eric was required to negotiate the note, to participate in the negotiation, that you can still go back and recover from the promissors of the note, his half?
Essentially, yes. He was required to have negotiated it. And more to the point, there was fraud and misrepresentation making him think that he was going to get his half, and then it was just wired, the money was just wired to his wife's
but
account.
But this is an action for conversion against the wife's and the assets that she retained in her account from the payment of the note from the Whitneys, right?
Correct. That is
and right. So the claim is you've got part of my money that's in your account because I was to get half of the loan proceeds, the repayment of the notes, not the loan proceeds, but the half of the repayment when they're made. Half of that should go into my account, and half of it should go into the wife's account.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Or the
exactly.
ex-wife's account.
And there can't be an accord and satisfaction because, one, there wasn't a bona fide dispute, and, two, in order for that to occur, one of the elements of substitute performance has to be tendered in full satisfaction of the claim. So they would have had to make clear, this divorce is going to settle that issue. This is an issue. I'm tendering this divorce.
So you're here on a summary judgment.
Right. They granted summary judgment based on the accord and satisfaction. And besides the fact that those elements weren't met, also they shouldn't have gotten summary judgment because all we need to survive summary judgment is one disputed fact, right? There were about six.
Material fact.
What?
Material fact.
A disputed material fact. Well, we had all kinds of them. One, that plaintiff knew that she was taking his money. That's in dispute. That there was a bona fide dispute in the case at the time of the divorce is in dispute. Exactly when the dispute arose and when plaintiff learned of the issue, that's in dispute. Whether or not he'd been lulled into this is in dispute. Whether or not that promissory note was included in the divorce settlement is in dispute. Whether or not the plaintiff authorized her to keep those funds is in dispute. What he meant when he said, you're going to do what you're going to do is in dispute. And whether the plaintiff was notified by the bank.
Well, what did your pleadings allege when you brought the action for conversion? What did you claim happened?
That she took half of his money because they both needed to release that under the promissory note of the UCC, that it could not be negotiated by one without the other. And that she did this transaction without his awareness and converted his funds.
Your rebuttal time is slipping away, and I want to give you a chance to address the cross-appeal that has to do with the partition of the other notes. What's your view on that?
Well, the problem with the partition and the notes, the judge did it right below because the notes are not identical. She wants to say, hey, I'm going to keep this note, he gets that note, and I'll even let him have the bigger note. But one secures shares in a Taekwondo studio, the other secures real property. There's various degrees of collectability on those notes. They're not the same, and that's why they need to divide it half down the middle on each, not you take one, I take
one. So who's going to be, if it's undivided ownership, who's going to be the holder of those notes?
We're having them partitioned by another court. There's another action to partition them so they each hold half equally, and then they can do what they want with their own half.
Well, You're going to tear the negotiable instrument down the middle, or?
No, tear their interest down the middle. Have the court say that.
Well, but my problem is, conceptually, I'm having problems with that concept, because the negotiable instrument is a document that, under the UCC, certain rights attached to that document. There may be owners, but the document and its existence has significance.
Absolutely.
And how do you deal with that problem of you've got a single document and you're trying to divide it two ways?
That's where a separate action is brought for partition, and the court then, and we've done this, the court then says you have interest in this and you have interest in that, because you cannot tear the document down the middle. The court has to go in with those documents and say, now you have this interest and you have that interest. And
well, but my problem is, after that order, who holds the document?
Well, then they each hold a document with an interest in half of it.
So you're saying they each, well, they yes. can't have two originals.
Well, they have two new ones after the court does the partition. It gives them, it divides their interests, so one has interest in half.
So you think a court of equity has the power to create a new negotiable instrument as part of partition?
Yes, that's what a partition action essentially is.
The UCC supersedes the old indenture.
Well, that was still the remedy that's contemplated, though.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Benson, good morning.
Please, the court, counsel. My name is Sheila Benson of Grimble-Lucky, representing Appellee Julia Zorn as the trustee of the Julia Zorn's Revocable Trust. At its core, the case before you today is really about a disgruntled former spouse unhappy with his divorce settlement. Over 4 years ago, Eric Zorns and Julia Zorns entered into and finalized their divorce settlement. And at that time, they both testified that they intended that settlement to divide all of their assets and all of their debts. A year after that divorce was final, Eric DeSorns decided he was no longer happy with that deal, and he's essentially now before this court asking for a do-over. Well, the law does not grant do-over, and as the district court correctly found, the undisputed material facts in this case establish that during the divorce negotiations, Mr. Zorns knew that this Andrew Wolf residence tied to the promissory note had been sold. He knew that the debt attached to that note had been paid, and he testified in his deposition that during the divorce negotiations, he believed that there were proceeds of that note that he was entitled to. With all of this knowledge, with this belief that there was money out there that he should have half of, he entered into the divorce settlement and testified that he intended that settlement to divide all of he and Ms. Zorn's assets and debts. As a result, the district court correctly found that the undisputed material facts in this case established that Mr. Zorn's claim was barred by a court in satisfaction. As Ms. Carlson
was that based on the fact that the money that was loaned was Julia's and not Eric's?
No, I believe the district court based it on it. There is a genuine dispute about whether or not the money, the proceeds at issue, would constitute marital property. Just as is common in a divorce, people, the parties go back and forth about whether or not certain assets belong to one spouse or the other can be included in the marital pot. In this case, Julia viewed all of the notes as an outright gift. She thought, we don't need to divide them up. These are just a gift to our family members. Perhaps a little bit naively, who cares how they're titled, we're trying to get them property, save some tax consequences. And as the letters submitted into evidence going between Julia's counsel and Mr. Zorn's counsel demonstrate, Eric took a different position, thus demonstrating the genuine dispute. He wanted those notes divided up in the divorce. He wanted a portion of the note proceeds.
Are they listed in the divorce settlement?
It's correct, it wasn't a specific line item in the divorce. However, under accord and satisfaction, the second element, a substitute performance rendered in full satisfaction of the debt, you don't have to have a line item of every dispute. I believe it's this court's case in High Plains Co-op that says an executed compromise settlement of a good faith controversy is in accord and satisfaction. In that case, the parties had a bunch of disputed items between them. One party wrote a check and he wrote on the memo line, this settles everything, or something to that effect, and the other party cashed the check. This court said that's an accord and satisfaction. Here, the parties had lots of different things in dispute during the divorce, last-minute courtroom divorce settlement, and they testified, Mr. Zorns testified under oath, that he intended the divorce to settle all these issues. And importantly, prior to the divorce, he's admitted in his deposition that he, at that time, believed he is entitled to some proceeds from the payoff.
So they had it. Is this what the evidence then showed? At the time of the divorce, they may have had a different view of the character of this asset, because her view is over time it morphs into a gift.
Correct. She
viewed
it
in accordance with the tax consequences, right? And his view of it is it's still looking like a note at this point in time.
Exactly, Your Honor. She thought it was kind of like a pledge to charity. It's a gift. And he said, no, I'm entitled to this. And rather than take this to trial and try the issue of how we should divide it, they decided we're just going to settle all these issues. And the divorce settlement divided all their assets and debts. By this point, the proceeds had gone into Julia's account, restructured into a new note. So she, in her mind, the gifting's still taking place. It's just a new promissory note. And Eric testified he believed he was entitled to proceeds. His attorney was free to pursue those proceeds, certainly did, but as is often the case in a divorce, there's a last-minute settlement. In this case, Julia agreed to a lower equalization payment. She gave up some items of personal property, and this was supposed to settle the dispute between the parties.
Does the record tell us what happened to the original promissory note?
With regard to the question of who physically has the note,
yes.
I can't answer that question. I know the indebtedness was paid off, and I'd like to briefly address some of the claims of misrepresentation and fraud, which I believe our brief addresses, and we vehemently deny that fact. Critically, in February 2010, Mr. Clare, who by this time did only represent Ms. Zorns, because in October Mr. Zorns signed the conflict of interest waiver, everything was done properly. Mr. Clare sent a letter to Mr. Zorns' independent counsel stating, this property has been sold, the indebtedness has been paid off. Mr. Zorns had all of the knowledge through his attorney of what was taking place. There was nothing being hidden from him. He was not hoodwinked. He had all of the facts. He testified in his deposition that he knew the property had been sold, he believed he was entitled to proceeds, and it was up to him and his attorney to pursue that in the divorce, as they did, and ultimately they decided to enter into a divorce settlement. The district court recognized this, and therefore properly determined that this was an accord and satisfaction. And certainly Mr. Zorns met the third element of an accord and satisfaction, which is the acceptance of the settlement, as he testified in court during the settlement proceedings, that he intended the divorce to settle all of their assets and debts. He doesn't now get to come 4 years later and try to reopen up the divorce settlement. Just as a policy principle, that this court doesn't want tons of disgruntled spouses trying to reopen these settlements. The facts of this case are clear and they're undisputed. Eric had the requisite knowledge. He pursued these assets in the divorce. He ultimately accepted the settlement. And today, he's bound by that settlement.
Aren't there a lot of disputes left in this? Disputes of material fact?
Not as it pertains to our affirmative defenses, and specifically the affirmative defense of accord and satisfaction. I would agree as to the plaintiff's conversion claim, whether or not Ms. Zorns had authority to restructure the note in her name alone. Yes, that's going to raise some genuine issues of material fact. However, when you look at the defense of accord and satisfaction, which is why we moved for summary judgment only on our affirmative defenses, there are no disputed material facts. Undisputed is that in February 2010, Mr. Zorns' attorney received a letter that said, property has been sold, indebtedness has been paid off. Mr. Zorns testified in his deposition that no later than March 2010, he believed there were note proceeds he was entitled to. Subsequent to that, he entered into a divorce settlement, and he testified he intended that to divide all of the assets and debts.
Well, it sounds more like judicial estoppel than accord and satisfaction.
I think it does, I mean, it does cross over into an estoppel argument, and that's why we briefed some of our other affirmative defenses, because the court didn't specifically reject those that this court could consider. And it kind of ties into a ratification, waiver, estoppel. All of those elements are met, because here what we really have is a party who had all knowledge of the facts, entered into a settlement, and then didn't question it, didn't do anything for 3 years. So no matter how you frame it, the facts, the undisputed material facts are there that would allow us to prevail on those affirmative defenses.
Before your time runs out, you want to turn to the cross appeal?
Yes, thank you. We have filed a cross appeal in this matter on two issues, attorney's fees and partition. I believe our brief adequately covers the fees issue, so I will address the partition issue. I do believe courts of equity have the power to partition promissory notes, but the key principle is here, they must do it consistent with the principles of the Uniform Commercial Code. And unfortunately, as we review this, we don't believe that the district court applied the principles of the Uniform Commercial Code.
Is there a particular section you'd like care to cite me to?
Yes, it's section 3-110, subsection D. And I'd also point the court to the comments of that section. The comments are quoted in our brief. But this part of the UC states, if an instrument is payable to two or more persons, not alternatively, it is payable to all of them and may be negotiated, discharged, or enforced only by all of them. In essence, when you have co-holders of a note, as we do here, the parties must act in concert to enforce the note. Here, the district court issued an order, and he ordered each party in severalty a distinct one-half interest in each respective note. Well, practically, that can have no legal effect. You can't have more than one holder of the note. And that's where the comment to this provision, I may finish.
You may finish. What is your solution to this?
The parties in this case agreed partition was appropriate. And I think the only way you can partition and not offend the UCC is the district court, as a court of equity, would have had the power to order the parties to assign each other their interest in the respective notes. Then the original notes are in place, and you can't mess with those because you have a maker of the note who has his or her own unique interest. That note stays the same. But if the parties each assign their interest in each respective note, then we have one holder of the note, the maker's rights are not disturbed, and yes, the notes have some variances, they're different values, but as a court of equity, the district court could have taken into those factors and could have partitioned the notes in that way. That's the only way to partition the notes. Otherwise, the parties have to just keep being co-holders, and as the parties were at least in agreement, that doesn't work.
And if there's a difference in value, the court would make it up in cash, essentially.
It could, or as a court in equity could decide. In this case, actually, our client offered to take the lower value note. It was her relative, and so she thought she wants to continue the gifting. But the court certainly would have the power to make that up. The court of equity can take into all those factors and decide.
So you want us to send it back down for further proceedings on it?
I think in this case the court would have the power to say that the district court should have ordered in that way. But if you remand to the district court with instructions that we think this contravenes the UCC, partition in this way is only appropriate if you assign the respective interests, and if this court believes there's more factors that the court should take into account, then I do think it's appropriate to send it back down, allow that court in equity to determine, okay, if we assign an interest, is there any more we need to do to make sure this is the most equitable solution? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. That concludes arguments for the day. Court is adjourned, and you are excused.